This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin.
Beyond Order, 12 More Rules for Life. This is the author, Dr. Jordan B. Peterson. To my wife, Tammy Maureen Roberts Peterson, whom I have loved deeply for 50 years, and who is admirable in my estimation, in all regards and beyond all reason. A note from the author in the time of the pandemic. It is a perplexing task to produce a nonfiction book during the global crisis brought about by the spread of COVID-19. It seems absurd in some sense even to think about anything else but that illness during this trying time. Nonetheless, binding all the thoughts contained in any current work to the existence of the pandemic, which too shall pass, seems like an error, as the normal problems of life will return at some point and, thankfully, to the forefront. That all means that an author of the present day is inevitably going to make one mistake, concentrating too much on the pandemic, which has an uncertain lifespan, and producing a book that is instantly dated in consequence, or another mistake, ignoring the pandemic, which is very much like failing to attend to the proverbial elephant under the rug. After considering this, as well as discussing the issues with my publishers, I decided to write Beyond Order, 12 More Rules for Life, according to the plan laid out for it several years ago, and to concentrate on addressing issues not specific to the current time, thus to risk the second error rather than the first. I suppose it may also be the case that those who have chosen to read this book or listen to the audio version might be relieved to turn their attention to something other than the coronavirus and the devastation it has wrought. Overture. On the 5th of February, 2020, I awoke in an intensive care ward in, of all places, Moscow. I had 6-inch tethers attaching me to the sides of the bed because, in my unconscious state, I had been agitated enough to try to remove the catheters from my arm and leave the ICU. I was confused and frustrated, not knowing where I was, surrounded by people speaking a foreign language, and in the absence of my daughter, Michaela, and her husband, Andre, who were restricted to short visiting hours and did not have permission to be there with me at my moment of wakening. I was angry, too, about being there, and lunged at my daughter when she did visit several hours later. I felt betrayed, although that was the furthest from the truth. People had been attending to my various needs with great diligence, and in the wake of the tremendous logistic challenges that come about from seeking medical care in a truly foreign country. I did not, and still do not, have any memory of anything that happened to me during the 4 weeks in Russia preceding that, and very little between those weeks and my having entered a hospital in Toronto in mid-December. One of the few things that I can recall, looking back to the earliest days of the year, was the time I had spent writing this book. I wrote much and edited almost all of Beyond Order during a time when my family was plagued by sequential and overlapping bouts of seriously impaired health, much of which was the subject of public discussion, and for that reason requires some detailed explanation. First, in January 2019, Michaela had to seek out a surgeon to replace much of her artificial ankle implanted about a decade earlier, as the initial installation was never perfect, causing her serious pain and trouble with movement as a consequence, and then came near to failing. I spent a week with her at a hospital in Zurich, Switzerland, for that procedure and her initial recovery. At the beginning of March, my wife Tammy underwent what we had been assured was routine surgery in Toronto for a common and eminently treatable kidney cancer. A month and a half after that surgery, which involved the removal of 1/3 of the organ in question, we learned that she was actually suffering from an extremely rare malignancy which had a 1-year fatality rate of close to 100%. 2 weeks later, The surgeons involved in her care removed the remaining 2/3 of her afflicted kidney, along with a substantial proportion of the related abdominal lymphatic system. The surgery appeared to bring the progression of the cancer to a halt, but produced leakage of fluid up to 4 liters or 1 gallon a day from her now damaged lymphatic system, a condition known as chylous ascites, which rivaled the original condition in danger and which persisted for several months. In desperation, we journeyed to see a medical team in Philadelphia, where within 96 hours of the initial injection of a poppy seed oil dye, whose practical purpose was the enhancement of images derived from CAT or MRI scans, the complete cessation of Tammy's fluid loss was achieved. This breakthrough occurred on the very day of our 30th wedding anniversary. She recovered rapidly and to all appearances completely, a testament to the luck without which none of us can live and to her own admirable strength and resistance. Unfortunately, while these events unfolded, my health fell apart. I had begun to take an anti-anxiety agent at the beginning of 2017 after suffering from what appeared to be an autoimmune reaction to something I had consumed during the Christmas holiday period of 2016. This food reaction made me acutely and continually anxious, as well as freezing cold, no matter what clothes I was wearing or how many blankets I layered upon myself. Further, it lowered my blood pressure so dramatically that whenever I tried to stand, I would gray out and be forced into a crouch half a dozen or more times before trying again. I also experienced insomnia that appeared near total. My family physician prescribed a benzodiazepine, as well as a drug for sleeping. I took the latter a mere handful of times before ceasing its use entirely. The terrible symptoms I was experiencing, including the insomnia, were almost immediately and entirely eradicated by the benzodiazepine treatment, making the sleep agent unnecessary. However, I continued the benzodiazepine for almost exactly 3 years, because my life did seem unnaturally stressful during that time. The period when my life changed from the quiet existence of a university professor and clinician to the tumultuous reality of a public figure. And because I believed that this drug was, as is often claimed of benzodiazepines, a relatively harmless substance. Things changed, however, in March 2019 at the onset of my wife's medical battle. My anxiety had spiked noticeably after Michaela's aforementioned hospitalization, surgery, and recovery. In consequence, I asked my family physician to increase my dose of benzodiazepine so that I would not be preoccupied by, nor preoccupy others, with my anxiety. Unfortunately, I experienced a marked increase in negative emotion following the adjustment. By this time, we were attempting to deal with the second of Tammy's surgeries and its complications, and I attributed my even more severe anxiety to that problem. I asked to have the dosage raised yet again, but my anxiety increased even further. I attributed all of this not to a paradoxical reaction to the medication, which it was later diagnosed as, but to the recurrence of a tendency towards depression that had plagued me for years. In any case, I ceased using the benzodiazepine entirely in May of that year, trying 2 doses of ketamine within a week, as suggested by a psychiatrist with whom I consulted. Ketamine, a non-standard anesthetic/psychedelic, sometimes has overwhelming and sudden positive effects on depression. It produced nothing for me but 2 90-minute trips to hell. I felt to my bones as if I had everything to feel guilty and ashamed about, with nothing gained by my positive experiences. A few days after the second ketamine experience, I began to suffer the effects of acute benzodiazepine withdrawal, which were truly intolerable. Anxiety far beyond what I had ever experienced, an uncontrollable restlessness and need to move, formerly known as akathisia, overwhelming thoughts of self-destruction, and the complete absence of any happiness whatsoever. A family friend, a physician, enlightened me as to the dangers of sudden benzodiazepine withdrawal. I therefore started to take a benzodiazepine once again, but a smaller dose than I had climbed to previously. Many, but not all, of my symptoms abated. To deal with those that remained, I also began to take an antidepressant that had been of great use to me in the past. All this did, however, was make me exhausted enough to require an additional 4 or more hours of sleep a day, which was not helpful in the midst of Tammy's serious health issues, as well as increase my appetite 2 or 3-fold. After about 3 months of terrible anxiety, uncontrollable hypersomnia, viciously torturous akathisia, and excessive appetite, I traveled to an American clinic that claimed to specialize in rapid benzodiazepine withdrawal. Despite the good intentions of many of its psychiatrists, the clinic managed only a slow tapering of my benzodiazepine dosage, the negative effects of which I was already experiencing, and which were not and could not be controlled to any significant degree whatsoever by the inpatient treatment offered. I resided at that clinic, nonetheless, from mid-August, a mere few days after Tammy had recovered from her post-surgical complications, to late November, when I returned home to Toronto, much the worse for wear. By this time, the akathisia, the disorder of uncontrollable movement alluded to earlier, had increased to the point where I could not sit or rest in any position for any length of time whatsoever without severe distress. In December, I checked into a local hospital, and it was at that point that my awareness of events prior to my awakening in Moscow ends. As I later learned, Michaela and Andre removed me from the Toronto hospital in early January 2020, believing that the treatment I received there was doing me more harm than good, an opinion I concurred with entirely once I learned of it. The situation I found myself in upon reattaining consciousness in Russia was complicated by the fact that I had also developed double pneumonia in Canada, although that was neither discovered nor treated until I was in the Moscow ICU. However, I was there primarily so that the clinic could facilitate my withdrawal from benzodiazepines using a procedure either unknown or regarded as too dangerous in North America. Since I had not been able to tolerate any decrease in dosage whatsoever, apart from the initial reduction months before, the clinic placed me in a medically induced coma so that I might remain unconscious during the very worst withdrawal symptoms. That regimen started January 5th and lasted 9 days, during which I was also placed in a machine so that my breathing was mechanically regulated. On January 14th, I was taken off the anesthetic and the intubation. I woke up for a few hours and indicated during this time to Michaela that I was no longer suffering from akathisia, although I remember nothing of this. On January 23rd, I was moved to another ICU specializing in neurological rehabilitation. I can recall waking up on the 26th for a short period until my more complete return to consciousness, as previously related, on February 5th, 10 days during which I passed through a period of delirium of vivid intensity. Once that cleared, I moved to a more home-like rehabilitation center in the outer suburbs of Moscow. While there, I had to relearn how to walk up and down stairs, button my clothes, lie down in bed on my own, place my hands in the proper position on a computer keyboard, and type. I did not seem to be able to see properly, or more accurately, see how to use my limbs to interact with what I perceived. A few weeks later, after the problems in perception and coordination had essentially abated, Michaela, Andre, their daughter Elizabeth Scarlett, and I relocated to Florida for what we hoped would be some peaceful time of recuperation in the sun, very much welcome after the cold grayness of midwinter Moscow. This was immediately before worldwide concern erupted over the COVID-19 pandemic. In Florida, I attempted to wean off the medication prescribed by the Moscow clinic, although I was still experiencing numbness in my left hand and foot, trembling of those two extremities, as well as the muscles in my forehead, seizure activity, and crippling anxiety. All these symptoms increased quite markedly as my intake of medication decreased, reaching the point where about 2 months later I returned to the dosages initially prescribed in Russia. This was a material defeat, as the process of lessening their use had been fueled by an optimism that was consequently shattered, as well as returning me to a state of medication usage that I had paid a heavy price for trying to eliminate. I had family members and friends stay with me during this time, thankfully, and their company helped me stay motivated to continue while the symptoms I was experiencing grew unbearable, particularly in the morning. By the end of May, 3 months after leaving Russia, it had become obvious that I was worsening instead of improving, and relying on the people I loved and who reciprocated that emotion was both untenable and unfair. Michaela and Andre had been in touch with a Serbian clinic that practiced a novel approach to the problem of benzodiazepine withdrawal, and they made arrangements to move me there only 2 days after that country had reopened after the pandemic closure. I am not going to make a claim that the events that befell my wife, me, and those who were closely involved in our care added up in the final analysis to some greater good. What happened to her was truly awful. She experienced a severe and near-fatal crisis of health every 2 or 3 days for more than half a year, and then had to cope with my illness and absence. I was plagued, for my part, with the likely loss of someone whom I had befriended for 50 years and been married to for 30, the observation of the terrible consequences of that on her other family members, including our children, and the dire and dreadful consequences of a substance dependence I had unwittingly stumbled into. I am not going to cheapen any of that by claiming that we became better people for living through it. However, I can say that passing so near to death motivated my wife to attend to some issues regarding her own spiritual and creative development more immediately and assiduously than she might otherwise have, and me to write or to preserve while editing only those words in this book that retained their significance even under conditions characterized by extreme suffering. It is certainly thanks to family and friends who are named specifically in the coda of this book that we are still alive. But it is also true that the meaningful immersion in what I was writing, which continued the entire time I have related, excepting my unconscious month in Russia, provided me both with a reason to live and a means of testing the viability of the thoughts with which I wrestled. I do not believe I have ever claimed, in my previous book, or indeed this one, that it would be necessarily sufficient to live by the rules I have presented. I think what I claimed, what I hope I claimed, was this. When you are visited by chaos and swallowed up, when nature curses you or someone you love with illness, or when tyranny rends asunder something of value that you have built, it is salutary to know the rest of the story. All of that misfortune is only the bitter half of the tale of existence, without taking note of the heroic element of redemption or the nobility of the human spirit requiring a certain responsibility to shoulder. We ignore that addition to the story at our peril, because life is so difficult that losing sight of the heroic part of existence would cost us everything. We do not want that to happen. We need instead to take heart and to take spirit and to look at things carefully and properly and to live the way that we could live. You have sources of strength upon which you can draw, and even though they may not work well, they may be enough. You have what you can learn if you can accept your error. You have medications and hospitals, as well as physicians and nurses who genuinely and bravely care to lift you up and help you through every day. And then you have your own character and courage, and if those have been beat to a bloody pulp and you are ready to throw in the towel, you have the character and courage of those for whom you care and who care for you. And maybe, just maybe, with all that, you can get through. I can tell you what has saved me so far: the love I have for my family, the love they have for me, the encouragement they have delivered, along with my friends, the fact that I still had meaningful work I could struggle through while in the abyss. I had to force myself to sit down at the computer. I had to force myself to concentrate and to breathe and to keep from saying and meaning to hell with it during the endless months that I was possessed by dread and terror. And I was barely able to do it. More than half the time, I believed that I was going to die in one of the many hospitals in which I resided. And I believe that if I had fallen prey to resentment, for example, I would have perished once and for all. And then I am fortunate to have avoided such a fate. Is it not possible, even though it may not always deliver us from the terrible situations we find ourselves in, that we would all be more able to deal with uncertainty, the horrors of nature, the tyranny of culture, and the malevolence of ourselves and others if we were better and more courageous people? If we strive toward higher values? If we were more truthful? Wouldn't the beneficial elements of experience be more likely to manifest themselves around us? Is it not possible, if your goals were noble enough, your courage adequate, your aim at the truth unerring, that the good thereby produced would, well, not justify the horror? That is not exactly right, but it still comes close. Such attitudes and actions might at least provide us with meaning sufficient to stop our encounter with that terror and horror from corrupting us and turning the surrounding world into something all too closely resembling hell. Why beyond order? It is simple in some regard. Order is explored territory. We are in order when the actions we deem appropriate produce the results we aim at. We regard such outcomes positively, indicating, as they do, first, that we have moved closer to what we desire, and second, that our theory about how the world works remains acceptably accurate. Nonetheless, all states of order, no matter how secure and comfortable, have their flaws. Our knowledge of how to act in the world remains eternally incomplete, partly because of our profound ignorance of the vast unknown, partly because of our willful blindness, and partly because the world continues in its entropic manner to transform itself unexpectedly. Furthermore, the order we strive to impose on the world can rigidify as a consequence of ill-advised attempts to eradicate from consideration all that is unknown. When such attempts go too far, totalitarianism threatens, driven by the desire to exercise full control, where such control is not possible, even in principle. This means risking a dangerous restriction of all the psychological and social changes necessary to maintain adaptation to the ever-changing world. And so we find ourselves inescapably faced with the need to move beyond order into its opposite, chaos. If order is where what we want makes itself known when we act in accordance with our hard-won wisdom, chaos is where what we do not expect or have remained blind to leaps forward from the potential that surrounds us. The fact that something has occurred many times in the past is no guarantee that it will continue to occur in the same manner. There exists, eternally, a domain beyond what we know and can predict. Chaos is anomaly, novelty, unpredictability, transformation, disruption, and all too often, dissent, as what we have come to take for granted reveals itself as unreliable. Sometimes it manifests itself gently, revealing its mysteries in experience that makes us curious, compelled, and interested. This is particularly likely, although not inevitable, when we approach what we do not understand voluntarily with careful preparation and discipline. Other times, the unexpected makes itself known terribly, suddenly, accidentally, so we are undone and fall apart and can only put ourselves back together with great difficulty, if at all. Neither the state of order nor the state of chaos is preferable intrinsically to the other. That is the wrong way to look at it. Nonetheless, in my previous book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, I focused more on how the consequences of too much chaos might be remediated. We respond to sudden and unpredictable change by preparing, physiologically and psychologically, for the worst. And because only God Himself knows what this worst might be, we must in our ignorance prepare for all eventualities. And the problem with that continual preparation is that, in excess, it exhausts us. But that does not imply in any manner that chaos should be eliminated, an impossibility in any case, although what is unknown needs to be managed carefully, as my previous book repeatedly stressed. Whatever is not touched by the new stagnates, and it is certainly the case that a life without curiosity, that instinct pushing us out into the unknown, would be a much diminished form of existence. What is new is also what is exciting, compelling, and provocative, assuming that the rate at which it is introduced does not intolerably undermine and destabilize our state of being. Like 12 Rules for Life, the current volume provides an explication of rules drawn from a longer list of 42 originally published and popularized on the Q&A website Quora. Unlike my previous book, Beyond Order explores as its overarching theme how the dangers of too much security and control might be profitably avoided. Because what we understand is insufficient, as we discover when things we are striving to control nonetheless go wrong around us, we need to keep one foot within order while stretching the other tentatively into the beyond. And so we are driven to explore and find the deepest of meanings in standing on the frontier, secure enough to keep our fear under control, but learning, constantly learning, as we face what we have not yet made peace with or adapted to. It is this instinct of meaning, something far deeper than mere thought, that orients us properly in life so that we do not become overwhelmed by what is beyond us or, equally dangerously, stultified and stunted by dated, too narrow, or too pridefully paraded systems of value and belief. What have I written about, more specifically? Rule 1 describes the relationship between stable, predictable social structures and individual psychological health, and makes the case that such structures need to be updated by creative people if they are to retain their vitality. Rule 2 analyzes a centuries-old alchemical image, relying on several stories, ancient and modern, to illuminate the nature and development of the integrated human personality. Rule 3 warns of the dangers of avoiding the information vital to the continual rejuvenation of the psyche, signaled by the emergence of negative emotions such as pain, anxiety, and fear. Rule 4 argues that the meaning that sustains people through difficult times is to be found not so much in happiness, which is fleeting, but in the voluntary adoption of mature responsibility for the self and others. Rule 5 uses a single example, drawn from my experience as a clinical psychologist, to illustrate the personal and social necessity of attending to the dictates of conscience. Rule 6 describes the danger of attributing the cause of complex individual and social problems to single variables, such as sex, class, or power. Rule 7 outlines the crucial relationship between disciplined striving in a single direction and forging of the individual character capable of resilience in the face of adversity. Rule 8 focuses on the vital importance of aesthetic experience as a guide to what is true, good, and sustaining in the human world of experience. Rule 9 makes the case that past experiences, whose current recall remains laden with pain and fear, can be stripped of their horror by voluntary verbal exploration and reconsideration. Rule 10 notes the importance of explicit negotiation to maintenance of the goodwill, mutual regard, and heartfelt cooperation without which no true romance can be sustained. Rule 11 opens by describing the world of human experience in a manner that explains what motivates three common but direly dangerous patterns of psychological response, delineates the catastrophic consequences of falling prey to any or all of them, and lays out an alternative route. Rule 12 makes the case that thankfulness, in the face of the inevitable tragedies of life, should be regarded as a primary manifestation of the admirable moral courage required to continue our difficult march uphill. I hope that I am somewhat wiser in my explication of this second set of 12 rules than I was 4 years ago when I wrote about the first dozen, not least because of the informative feedback I received in the course of my efforts to formulate my ideas for audiences around the world, in person, on YouTube and through my podcast and blog. I hope, in consequence, that I have managed to clarify some of the issues that were perhaps left less than optimally developed in my previous work, as well as presenting much that is original. Finally, I hope that people find this book as helpful personally as they seem to have found the first set of 12 rules. It has been a source of immense gratification that so many people have reported drawing strength from the thoughts and the stories I have had the privilege of bringing forth and sharing.
Rule 1. Do not carelessly denigrate social institutions or creative achievement. Loneliness and confusion. For years, I saw a client who lived by himself. Note, I have modified the accounts drawn from my clinical practice enough to ensure the continuing privacy of my clients while endeavoring to maintain the essential narrative truth of what I am relating. He was isolated in many other ways in addition to his living situation. He had extremely limited family ties. Both of his daughters had moved out of the country and did not maintain much contact, and he had no other relatives except a father and sister from whom he was estranged. His wife and the mother of his children had passed away years ago, and the sole relationship he endeavored to establish while he saw me over the course of more than a decade and a half terminated tragically when his new partner was killed in an automobile accident. When we began to work together, our conversations were decidedly awkward. He was not accustomed to the subtleties of social interaction, so his behaviors, verbal and nonverbal, lacked the dance-like rhythm and harmony that characterized the socially fluent. As a child, he had been thoroughly ignored as well as actively discouraged by both parents. His father, mostly absent, was neglectful and sadistic in his inclinations, while his mother was chronically alcoholic. He had also been consistently tormented and harassed at school and had not chanced upon a teacher in all his years of education who paid him any genuine attention. These experiences left my client with a proclivity toward depression, or at least worsened what might have been a biological tendency in that direction. He was, in consequence, abrupt, irritable, and somewhat volatile if he felt misunderstood or was unexpectedly interrupted during a conversation. Such reactions helped ensure that his targeting by bullies continued into his adult life, particularly in his place of work. I soon noticed, however, that things worked out quite well during our sessions if I kept mostly quiet. He would drop in, weekly or biweekly, and talk about what had befallen and preoccupied him during the previous 7 to 14 days. If I maintained silence for the first 50 minutes of our one-hour sessions, listening intently, then we could converse in a relatively normal, reciprocal manner for the remaining 10 minutes. This pattern continued for more than a decade, as I learned increasingly to hold my tongue, something that does not come easily to me. As the years passed, however, I noticed that the proportion of time he spent discussing negative issues with me decreased. Our conversation, his monologue really, had always started with what was bothering him and rarely progressed past that. But he worked hard outside our sessions, cultivating friends, attending artistic gatherings and music festivals, resurrecting a long-dormant talent composing songs and playing the guitar. As he became more social, he began to generate solutions to the problems he communicated to me, and to discuss, in the latter portion of the hours we shared, some of the more positive aspects of his existence. It was slow going, but he made continual incremental progress. When he first came to see me, we could not sit together at a table in a coffee shop, or indeed in any public space, and practice anything resembling a real-world conversation without his being paralyzed into absolute silence. By the time we finished, he was reading his original poetry in front of small groups and had even tried his hand at stand-up comedy. He was the best personal and practical exemplar of something I had come to realize over my more than 20 years of psychological practice. People depend on constant communication with others to keep their minds organized. We all need to think to keep things straight, but we mostly think by talking. We need to talk about the past so that we can distinguish the trivial, overblown concerns that otherwise plague our thoughts from the experiences that are truly important. We need to talk about the nature of the present and our plans for the future so we know where we are, where we are going, and why we are going there. We must submit the strategies and tactics we formulate to the judgments of others to ensure their efficiency and resilience. We need to listen to ourselves as we talk as well, so that we may organize our otherwise inchoate bodily reactions, motivations, and emotions into something articulate and organized, and dispense with those concerns that are exaggerated and irrational. We need to talk, both to remember and to forget. My client desperately needed someone to listen to him. He also needed to be fully part of additional, larger, and more complex social groups, something he planned in our sessions together and then carried out on his own. Had he fallen prey to the temptation to denigrate the value of interpersonal interactions and relationships because of his history of isolation and harsh treatment, he would have had very little chance of regaining his health and well-being. Instead, he learned the ropes and joined the world. Sanity as a social institution. For Drs. Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, the great depth psychologists, sanity was a characteristic of the individual mind. People were well adjusted in their views when the subpersonalities existing within each of them were properly integrated and balanced in expression. The id, the instinctive part of the psyche, from the German it, representing nature in all its power and foreignness inside us. The superego, the sometimes oppressive internalized representative of social order. And the ego, the I, the personality proper, crushed between those two necessary tyrants, all had their specialized functions for Freud, who first conceptualized their existence. Id, ego, and superego interacted with each other like the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of a modern government. Jung, although profoundly influenced by Freud, parsed the complexity of the psyche in a different manner. For him, the ego of the individual had to find its proper place in relationship to the shadow, the dark side of the personality, the anima or animus, the contrasexual and thus often repressed side of the personality, and the self, the internal being of ideal possibility. But all these different sub-entities, Jungian and Freudian alike, share one thing in common. They exist in the interior of the person, regardless of his or her surroundings. People are social beings, however, par excellence, and there is no shortage of wisdom and guidance outside of us, embedded in the social world. Why rely on our own limited resources to remember the road or to orient ourselves in new territory when we can rely on signs and guideposts placed there so effortfully by others? Freud and Jung, with their intense focus on the autonomous individual psyche, placed too little focus on the role of the community in the maintenance of personal mental health. It is for such reasons that I assess the position of all my new clinical clients along a few dimensions largely dependent on the social world when I first start working with them. Have they been educated to the level of their intellectual ability or ambition? Is their use of free time engaging, meaningful, and productive? Have they formulated solid and well-articulated plans for the future? Are they, and those they are close to, free of any serious physical health or economic problems? Do they have friends in a social life, a stable and satisfying intimate partnership, close and functional familial relationships, a career, or at least a job, that is financially sufficient, stable, and, if possible, a source of satisfaction and opportunity? If the answer to any three or more of these questions is no, I consider that my new client is insufficiently embedded in the interpersonal world and is in danger of spiraling downwards psychologically because of that. People exist among other people and not as purely individual minds. An individual does not have to be that well put together if he or she can remain at least minimally acceptable in behavior to others. Simply put, we outsource the problem of sanity. People remain mentally healthy not merely because of the integrity of their own minds, but because they are constantly being reminded how to think, act, and speak by those around them. If you begin to deviate from the straight and narrow path, if you begin to act improperly, people will react to your errors before they become too great and cajole, laugh, tap, and criticize you back into place.
They will raise an eyebrow, or smile, or not, or pay attention, or not. If other people can tolerate having you around, in other words, they will constantly remind you not to misbehave, and just as constantly call on you to be at your best. All that is left for you to do is watch, listen, and respond appropriately to the cues. Then you might remain motivated and able to stay together enough so that you will not begin the long journey downhill. This is reason enough to appreciate your immersion in the world of other people, friends, family members, and foes alike, despite the anxiety and frustration that social interactions so often produce. But how did we develop the broad consensus regarding social behavior that serves to buttress our psychological stability? It seems a daunting task, if not impossible, in the face of the complexity that constantly confronts us. Do we pursue this or that? How does the worth of this piece of work compare to the worth of that? Who is more competent, or more creative, or more assertive, and should therefore be ceded authority? Answers to such questions are largely formulated in consequence of intensive negotiation, verbal and nonverbal, regulating individual action, cooperation, and competition. What we deem to be valuable and worthy of attention becomes part of the social contract, part of the rewards and punishments meted out respectively for compliance and noncompliance, part of what continually indicates and reminds, here is what is valued. Look at that, perceive that, and not something else. Pursue that, act toward that end, and not some other. Compliance with those indications and reminders is, in large measure, sanity itself, and is something required from every one of us right from the early stages of our lives. Without the intermediation of the social world, it would be impossible for us to organize our minds, and we would simply be overwhelmed by the world. The point of pointing. I have the great good fortune of a granddaughter, Elizabeth Scarlett Peterson Korakova, born in August 2017. I have watched her carefully while she develops, trying to understand what she is up to and playing along with it. When she was about a year and a half old, she engaged in all manner of unbearably endearing behaviors, giggling and laughing when she was poked, high-fiving, bumping heads, and rubbing noses. However, in my opinion, the most noteworthy of all the actions she undertook at that age was her pointing. She had discovered her index finger, using it to specify all the objects in the world she found interesting. She delighted in doing so, particularly when her pointing called forth the attention of the adults surrounding her. This indicated, in a manner not duplicable in any other way, that her action and intention had import, definable at least in part, as the tendency of a behavior or attitude to compel the attention of others. She thrived on that. And no wonder. We compete for attention, personally, socially, and economically. No currency has a value that exceeds it. Children, adults, and societies wither on the vine in its absence. To have others attend to what you find important or interesting is to validate, first, the importance of what you are attending to, but second and more crucially, to validate you as a respected center of conscious experience and contributor to the collective world. Pointing is, as well, a crucial precursor to the development of language. To name something, to use the word for the thing, is essentially to point to it, to specify it against everything else, to isolate it for use individually and socially. When my granddaughter pointed, she did it publicly. When she pointed to something, she could immediately observe how the people close to her reacted. There is just not that much point, so to speak, in pointing to something that no one else cares about. So she aimed her index finger at something she found interesting and then looked around to see if anyone else cared. She was learning an important lesson at an early age. If you are not communicating about anything that engages other people, then the value of your communication, even the value of your very presence, risks falling to zero. It was in this manner that she began to more profoundly explore the complex hierarchy of value that made up her family and the broader society surrounding her. Scarlett is now learning to talk, a more sophisticated form of pointing and of exploration. Every word is a pointer,
as well as a simplification or generalization. To name something is not only to make it shine forth against the infinite background of potentially nameable things, but to group or categorize it simultaneously with many other phenomena of its broad utility or significance. We use the word floor, for example, but do not generally employ a separate word for all the floors we might encounter: concrete, wood, earth, glass, much less all the endless variations of color and texture and shade that make up the details of the floors that bear our weight. We use a low-resolution representation. If it holds us up, we can walk on it, and is situated inside a building, then it is a floor, and that is precise enough. The word distinguishes floors, say, from walls, but also restricts the variability in all the floors that exist to a single concept: flat, stable, walkable indoor surfaces. The words we employ are tools that structure our experience, subjectively and privately, but are equally socially determined. We would not all know and use the word floor unless we had all agreed that there was something sufficiently important about floors to justify a word for them. So the mere fact of naming something, and of course agreeing on the name, is an important part of the process whereby the infinitely complex world of phenomena and fact is reduced to the functional world of value. And it is continual interaction with social institutions that makes this reduction, this specification, possible. What should we point to? The social world narrows and specifies the world for us, marking out what is important. But what does important mean? How is it determined? The individual is molded by the social world, but social institutions are molded too by the requirements of the individuals who compose them. Arrangements must be made for our provisioning with the basic requirements of life. We cannot live without food, water, clean air, and shelter. Less self-evidently, we require companionship, play, touch, and intimacy. These are all biological as well as psychological necessities, and this is by no means a comprehensive list. We must signify and then utilize those elements of the world capable of providing us with these requirements. And the fact that we are deeply social adds another set of constraints to the situation. We must perceive and act in a manner that meets our biological and psychological needs. But since none of us lives or can live in isolation, we must meet them in a manner approved of by others. This means that the solutions we apply to our fundamental biological problems must also be acceptable and implementable socially. It is worth considering more deeply just how necessity limits the universe of viable solutions and implementable plans. First, as we alluded to, the plan must in principle solve some real problem. Second, it must appeal to others, often in the face of competing plans, or those others will not cooperate and might well object. If I value something, therefore, I must determine how to value it so that others potentially benefit. It cannot just be good for me. It must be good for me and for the people around me. And even that is not good enough, which means there are even more constraints on how the world must be perceived and acted upon. The manner in which I view and value the world, integrally associated with the plans I am making, has to work for me, my family, and the broader community. Furthermore, it needs to work today, in a manner that does not make a worse hash of tomorrow, next week, next month, and next year, even the next decade or century. A good solution to a problem involving suffering must be repeatable without deterioration across repetitions. Iterable, in a word, across people and across time. These universal constraints, manifest biologically and imposed socially, reduce the complexity of the world to something approximating a universally understandable domain of value. That is exceptionally important because there are unlimited problems and there are hypothetically unlimited potential solutions. But there are a comparatively limited number of solutions that work practically, psychologically, and socially simultaneously. The fact of limited solutions implies the existence of something like a natural ethic. Variable, perhaps, as human languages are variable,
but still characterized by something solid and universally recognizable at its base. It is the reality of this natural ethic that makes thoughtless denigration of social institutions both wrong and dangerous. Wrong and dangerous because those institutions have evolved to solve problems that must be solved for life to continue. They are by no means perfect, but making them better rather than worse is a tricky problem indeed. So, I must take the complexity of the world, reduce it to a single point so that I can act, and take everyone else and their future selves into consideration while I am doing so. How do I manage this? By communicating and negotiating. By outsourcing the terribly complex cognitive problem to the resources of the broader world. The individuals who compose every society cooperate and compete linguistically. Although linguistic interaction by no means exhausts the means of cooperation and competition. Words are formulated collectively, and everyone must agree on their use. The verbal framework that helps us delimit the world is a consequence of the landscape of value that is constructed socially, but also bounded by the brute necessity of reality itself. This helps give that landscape shape, and not just any old shape. This is where hierarchies, functional productive hierarchies, more clearly enter the picture. Things of import must be done, or people starve or die of thirst or exposure or of loneliness and absence of touch. What needs to be done must be specified and planned. The requisite skills for doing so must be developed. That specification, planning, and development of skills, as well as the implementation of the informed plan, must be conducted in social space with the cooperation of others and in the face of their competition. In consequence, some will be better at solving the problem at hand, and others worse. This variance in ability, as well as the multiplicity of extant problems and the impossibility of training everyone in all skilled domains, necessarily engenders a hierarchical structure, based ideally on genuine competence in relation to the goal. Such a hierarchy is, in its essence, a socially structured tool that must be employed for the effective accomplishment of necessary and worthwhile tasks. It is also a social institution that makes progress and peace possible at the same time. Bottom up. The consensus making up the spoken and unspoken assumptions of worth characterizing our societies has an ancient origin, developing over the course of hundreds of millions of years. After all, how should you act is just the short-term immediate version of the fundamental long-term question, how should you survive? It is therefore instructive to look into the distant past, far down the evolutionary chain, right to the basics, and contemplate the establishment of what is important. The most phylogenetically ancient multicellular organisms, that is far enough back for our purposes, tend to be composed of relatively undifferentiated sensory motor cells. These cells map certain facts or features of the environment directly onto the motor output of the same cells in an essentially one-to-one relationship. Stimulus A means response A, and nothing else, while stimulus B means response B. Among more differentiated and complex creatures, the larger and commonly recognizable denizens of the natural world, the sensory and motor functions separate and specialize such that cells undertaking the former functions detect patterns in the world, and cells in the latter produce patterns of motor output. This differentiation enables a broader range of patterns to be recognized and mapped, as well as a broader range of action and reaction to be undertaken. A third type of cell, neural, emerges sometimes as well, serving as a computational intermediary between the first two. Among species that have established a neural level of operation, the same pattern of input can produce a different pattern of output, depending, for example, on changes in the animal's environment or internal psychophysical condition. As nervous systems increase in sophistication and more layers of neural intermediation emerge, the relationship between simple fact and motor output becomes increasingly complex, unpredictable, and sophisticated. What is putatively the same thing or situation can be perceived in multiple ways, and two things perceived in the same manner can still give rise to very different behaviors. It is very difficult to constrain even isolated laboratory animals, for example, so thoroughly that they will behave predictably across trials that have been made as similar as possible. As the layers of neural tissue mediating between sensation and action multiply, they also differentiate. Basic motivational systems, often known as drives, appear: hunger, thirst, aggression, etc., adding additional sensory and behavioral specificity and variability. Superseding motivations, in turn, with no clear line of demarcation, are systems of emotion. Cognitive systems emerge much later, first taking form, arguably, as imagination, and later, and only among human beings, as full-fledged language. Thus, in the most complex of creatures, there is an internal hierarchy of structure, from reflex through drive to language-mediated action, in the particular case of human beings, that must be organized before it can function as a unity and be aimed at a point. How is this hierarchy organized? A structure that emerged in large part from the bottom up over vast spans of evolutionary time. We return to the same answer alluded to earlier. Through the constant cooperation and competition, the constant jockeying for resources and position, defining the struggle for survival and reproduction. This happens over the unimaginably lengthy spans of time that characterize evolution, as well as the much shorter course of each individual life. Negotiation for position sorts organisms into the omnipresent hierarchies that govern access to vital resources such as shelter, nourishment, and mates. All creatures of reasonable complexity and even a minimally social nature have their particular place and know it. All social creatures also learn what is deemed valuable by other group members and derive from that, as well as from the understanding of their own position, a sophisticated implicit and explicit understanding of value itself. In a phrase, the internal hierarchy that translates facts into actions mirrors the external hierarchy of social organization. It is clear, for example, that chimpanzees in a troop understand their social world and its hierarchical strata at a fine level of detail. They know what is important and who has privileged access to it. They understand such things as if their survival and reproduction depend upon it, as it does. A newborn infant is equipped with relatively deterministic reflexes: sucking, crying, startling. These nonetheless provide the starting point for the immense range of skills in action that develop with human maturation. By the age of 2, and often much earlier than that for many skills, children can orient with all their senses, walk upright, use their opposable thumb-equipped hands for all sorts of purposes, and communicate their desires and needs both non-verbally and verbally. And this is, of course, a partial list. This immense array of behavioral abilities is integrated into a complex assortment of emotions and motivational drives: anger, sadness, fear, joy, surprise, and more, and then organized to fulfill whatever specific narrow purpose inspires the child for the moment, and increasingly over longer spans of time. The developing infant must also hone and perfect the operation of his or her currently dominant motivational state in harmony with all his or her other internal motivational states. As, for example, the separate desire to eat, sleep, and play must learn to coexist so each can manifest itself optimally, and in keeping with the demands, routines, and opportunities of the social environment. This honing and perfecting begins within the child's maternal relationship, and the spontaneous play behavior within that circumscribed but still social context. Then, when the child has matured to the point where the internal hierarchy of emotional and motivational functions can be subsumed, even temporarily, within a framework provided by a conscious, communicable, abstract goal, let us play house, the child is ready to play with others, and to do so over time in an increasingly complex and sophisticated manner. Play with others depends, as the great developmental psychologist Jean Piaget observed, upon the collective establishment of a shared goal with the child's play partners. The collective establishment of a shared goal, the point of the game, conjoined with rules governing cooperation and competition in relationship to that goal or point, constitutes a true social microcosm. All societies might be regarded as variations upon this play/game theme. E pluribus unum. Out of many, one. And in all functional and decent societies, the basic rules of fair play, predicated upon reciprocity across situation and time, come inevitably to apply. Games, like solutions to problems, must be iterable to endure, and there are principles that apply to and undergird what constitutes that iterability. Piaget suspected, for example, that games undertaken voluntarily will outcompete games imposed and played under threat of force, given that some of the energy that could be expended on the game itself, whatever its nature, has to be wasted on enforcement. There is evidence indicating the emergence of such voluntary game-like arrangements even among our non-human kin. The universal rules of fair play include the ability to regulate emotion and motivation while cooperating and competing in pursuit of the goal during the game. That is part and parcel of being able to play at all, as well as the ability and will to establish reciprocally beneficial interactions across time and situation, as we already discussed. And life is not simply a game, but a series of games, each of which has something in common, whatever defines a game, and something unique, or there would be no reason for multiple games. At minimum, there's a starting point, kindergarten, a 0-0 score, a first date, an entry-level job, that needs to be improved upon, a procedure for enacting that improvement, and a desirable goal, graduation from high school, a winning score, a permanent romantic relationship, a prestigious career. Because of that commonality, there is an ethic, or more properly, a meta-ethic, that emerges from the bottom up across the set of all games. The best player is therefore not the winner of any given game, but, among many other things, he or she who is invited by the largest number of others to play the most extensive series of games. It is for this reason, which you may not understand explicitly at the time, that you tell your children, it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. Even rats understand this. Jak Panksepp, one of the founders of the psychological subfield called affective neuroscience, and an extremely creative, courageous, and gifted researcher, spent many years analyzing the role of play in the development and socialization of rats. Rats like to play. They particularly enjoy rough-and-tumble play, particularly if they are male juvenile rats. They enjoy it so much that they will voluntarily work, pulling a lever repeatedly, say, to gain the opportunity to enter an arena where another juvenile waits to play. When two juvenile strangers meet for the first time in this situation, they size each other up and then establish dominance. If one rat is only 10% larger than the other, he can pretty much win every physical contest, every rat wrestling match, but they still wrestle to find out, and the larger rat almost inevitably pins the smaller. If you were inclined to view the establishment of hierarchy as equivalent to dominance by power, that would be game over. The larger, more powerful rat won. End of story. But that is by no means the end of the story, unless the rats meet only once. Rats live in social environments, and they interact with the same individuals over and over. Thus, the game, once started, continues, and the rules have to govern not so much the single game as the repeating one. Once dominance is established, the rats can play, something they do in a manner very different from genuine fighting, just like play fighting with a pet dog is very different from being attacked by a dog. Now, the larger rat could pin the smaller rat every time. However, that breaks the rules. Really, the meta rules, those that are observable only over the course of repeated games. The purpose of the repeated game is not dominance, but continuing play. This is not to say that the initial dominance is without significance. It matters, not least in the following manner. When the two rats meet a second time, they will both adopt a unique role. The smaller rat is now duty-bound to invite his larger friend to play, and the larger rat is duty-bound to accept the invitation. The former will jump around playfully to indicate his intent. The larger rat might hang back and act cool and a bit dismissive, as is now his prerogative, but if he's a decent sort, he will join in the fun, as in his heart of hearts, he truly wants to play. However, and this is the critical issue, if the larger rat does not let the smaller rat win the repeated wrestling matches some substantial proportion of the time, Panksepp estimated 30-40% of the time, the smaller rat will stop exhibiting invitations to play. It is just not any fun for the little guy. Thus, if the larger rat dominates with power, like a bully, as he could, then he will lose at the highest level, the level where the fun continues for the longest possible time, even while he wins more frequently at the lower. What does this imply? Most important, that power is simply not a stable basis upon which to construct a hierarchy designed to optimally govern repeated interactions. And this is not just true for rats. Alpha males among at least certain primate groups are far more pro-social than their lesser comrades. Power doesn't work for them, either. How should you play to be that